Good morning.
Jemiah, I've received your memorandum, thank you, and members of the court have read it and discussed it. Is there anything you want to add?
Stuart, only what I've put toward the end of the memorandum in relation to seeking some clarity of function from the court.
Yes.
And just to make the point that the Director General is not trying to be obstructive here in any way, we're just trying to make sure what results here is helpful and is correct for the court to consider.
I mean, before I call on others to speak, I should say that the court shares the concern that the document would be headed expert witness, caucusing, conference and joint witness statement, and there hasn't been a caucusing or conferencing process, at least one organised by the court. We had anticipated that the document would be something which expert witnesses would have had some input to, but that it should primarily be a document trying to set out primary facts rather than matters of opinion or prediction of any kind. That's what we were looking for. So the heading may well be in error and should be clarified to that extent. And although I say matters of primary fact, there can be situations, and there will be in this case, and the obvious one will be what people judge to be ephemeral versus what people judge to be, say, intermittent, and that will have an effect on the lengths that are advised. And we would expect that the document might indicate that there's a difference of view about that sort of judgment. But other than that, we were not anticipating that there would be a further caucusing or conferencing process, that this would be the gathering of information, and then we would see where we went with that. And there may yet be a caucusing or conferencing process that arises out of it.
Yes, sir, that's certainly my understanding. All right. That's the concern with the title.
Well, indeed, and as I say, the court shares concern about that title. But other than that, in terms of the ability for you or the witnesses called by the Director General to participate in the process of contributing to the information that's in it,
yes, sir.
Have you been able to do that?
Yes, so this is where the concerns come from.
Yes.
So the experts have been working away, and I expect to have something at the end of today, unless they tell me otherwise. But yeah, that's the intent. We're trying to be as helpful as we can in this process. So
no, I understand that, but it is important that we know what the document is meant to be.
Yes, sir. That's the clarity I'm seeking.
Very good. Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honour. Yes, the point about the statement mentioning caucusing is one that had come up in a discussion.
You must want to step closer.
Yes, thank you. It came up in a discussion yesterday, and I've provided some feedback that perhaps it should be just titled Joint Witness Statement. Yes, just to make it clear, this is a statement of hopefully fact that has come together by input from the named experts, and where the facts are agreed, it's stated.
Yes.
Where they're not agreed, that can be stated too. And so, to that end, we'd be welcoming feedback and comments from other counsellors.
Is there anything else then on that issue that you want to raise with us?
No, I'm content with the way it's progressing, sir, and I'm looking forward to getting that into the court.
Thank you. Does any other party wish to be heard on that issue? Good. I think that that's reasonably clear, and I hope we can move forward on that basis. And then once the document is in a form, the parties are content for it to be filed with us, we'll have a look at it, and then we can have a discussion about what steps may need to follow from that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Any other housekeeping or preliminary matters anyone has? No. All right. Thompson, I think we return to you. And your next witness. Just while Mr. Thompson's getting organised, looking at the schedule, it's possible we might finish this week's witnesses by the end of tomorrow, isn't it? Ms. Carruthers, that's because it'll be your presentation tomorrow?
Yes, that's what I'm working towards, sir. My permissions and all my witnesses tomorrow. Depending, of course, on the time.
Well, absolutely. Well, we're just trying to sort of keep an eye on things. Very good. Thank you.
Beacon Lamb Court's Jane Crystal.
Thank you.
The use of all Almighty God as evidence of God's protection of the sport shall be approved the whole truth and nothing but the truth.
Good morning, members of the court. Good morning, Dr. Crystal. Is your name Jane Marie Crystal? And are you the Principal Science Advisor, Farm Systems and Environment at Beacon Lamb New Zealand Limited? And did you prepare a brief of evidence dated 28 July 2023 and a brief of evidence in reply dated 11 August 2023? And were you also a participant in expert system conferencing of farm systems experts that resulted in the production of a joint witness statement dated 11 September 2023? And do you confirm your opinions in that joint witness statement are in accordance with the expert witness code of conduct for the Environment Court and its practice note? And do you confirm that you have the qualifications and experience set out in the evidence in chief that I mentioned earlier? Do you have any corrections in either your evidence in chief or evidence in reply that you wish to make?
Yes, I have five for my evidence in chief.
So I'll ask you then to please take us through those. Please just take your cues from the court, make sure they're keeping up with you, and take them to the paragraphs and lines so that you can make the changes.
Paragraph 28.
Sorry.
Yeah. Cross out the E. coli.
Yes.
E. coli versus
subject to those changes, Dr. Crystal, do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of knowledge and belief, and in accordance with the expert witness code of conduct?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. I have a handful of questions for you before I hand you over to my friends and ultimately the court. Because you've just mentioned it, I'll perhaps ask by asking you a question about your paragraph 113. That paragraph starts with, it's after paragraph 13, there's an unnumbered paragraph, and that reads, E. coli loss is the highest in horticulture, which you go on to say is an anomaly. Do you wish to explain that anomaly any further?
Sure. So I'll preface it by saying that I'm not a water quality scientist. However, I use the SANS report and my understanding of the way the analysis was done for that was that for sediment and nitrogen and phosphorus, the calculations were done using models, and for E. coli, it was done using water quality data. And I suspect it's just the fact that it's very difficult to link that back to our land use because of the size of the land use in question. But the data, that is what the data shows.
Thank you.
Do you mean by that that although the samples might have been in the vicinity of horticultural activities, there may also have been pastoral or other stock activities which would, or other animals which would have led to the E. coli?
Yes, avian or from further
up. Oh, avian as well,
yes.
And while we're on the SANS paper that you cite and analyse in your evidence, I understand you were in court yesterday.
Yes.
And did you hear Commissioner Hodges ask any questions about the sources of nitrogen from different farming, pastoral farming systems?
Yes, I did.
Are you able to assist the Commissioner and the other members of the court on that issue?
Yes, I can. I use the data in the SANS report for my evidence. And if I take you just across the page to page 34, the SANS report gave high rates of the data, and what that report gave were the loads attributed to land use, and as I mentioned before, those loads were calculated for E. coli from all the quality samples, but for sediment, nitrous and phosphorus by modelling, so NZ for sediment and overseas for nitrogen and phosphorus, and then they used land use data to get the area in each catchment. What I did was get that data and back calculate using the land use to work out what the loads land use work. And so if we go over the page, we've got an example there of the loads of the four tenants of concern by land use. And so we can see there we've got sugar land in the blue line, dairy in the orange, horticulture in the grey, forestry green, miscellaneous, urban in the avoiding dairy support. Those data show that nitrogen, both at the catchment but also when we look at the hybrids, a lot of those is greater than 50% of the load of from dairy compared to dry stock. And then when we come down to on a say a per hectare basis, dairy is also showing for nitrogen, as was in some of the subcategories
Now, the other thing that you did in your evidence, Dr. Crystal, was you undertook a literature review to identify the literature on environmental actions adopted by sheep and beef farmers to reduce contaminant losses, and then you assessed that against the effectiveness of mitigation actions contained in FEPs as contemplated by Plan Change 1, which would include freshwater farm plans and other regulations. And that literature review you provided was in draft, is that correct?
Yes, very much so.
And your intention is to publish that literature review?
Yes, sir.
Has there been any updates on the publication of that literature review?
No, it's still to be finalised and published, but that is still the intention.
And was that literature review peer reviewed?
Yes, I had that peer reviewed by Drs. Morgan and Lighton and Research.
That's the draft of peer review?
Draft, yes.
That you presented to the court? Now, again, you were in court yesterday and you've actually been observing or in court for the entire hearing to date.
Yes.
Quite an effort. Well done. And you've heard there's been a number of questions about Overseer.
Yes.
And if I understand correctly, you were involved in the technical advisory group that fed into the Overseer redevelopment program. Is that correct?
Was involved in the technical advisory group that up in the first meeting that was pulled together to consider the work as it was being done. So we weren't doing the review the work, but we were reviewing what was being done.
So if the court has questions about Overseer, you'll be in a position to assist?
Yes.
And your evidence records that you read the evidence of Mr. Allen? And attached to the evidence of Mr. Allen was a paper by Amicus Bio.
Yes.
Now, I understand from the week I wasn't here that Commissioner Hodges had some questions about that paper.
Yeah.
Can you describe that paper and what it did and what it said briefly, please?
Briefly. Okay. I'll do my best. So, again, I wasn't an author on the paper, so, but I've read that paper, and what that was doing an analysis of the NRIS scorecard at that time and trying to analyse how good it was at predicting raft depletion loss and N surplus, which are both calculations as part of Overseer. So they had around 6,000 farms that they then took and modelled, took the input data that goes into the NRIS scorecard, and they modelled those in Overseer. They then looked at each of the different components separately, so by altering stock numbers on its own, to see what the impact of that was on the N leaching or the N surplus, and compared that to how the difference in the numerical value given by the N risk scorecard. They did that for the six main areas within the NRIS scorecard, so irrigation, cropping, stock management, fertiliser, and then the subcomponents as well. They identified a few subcomponents that were overly sensitive in predicting under the NRIS scorecard, and they recommended that those were corrected. And from reading of the report says that that correction occurred. And there was talk yesterday about the R squared being less than 50. And when we look at the recent Overseer report, we can see that the main components of the sensitivity analysis report, the main components that influence in leaching, climate, soil moisture, and soil type. And so what that's telling me is that the NRIS scorecard is doing pretty well with the factors that are in there, but it is missing those, as we've heard, the biophysical factors,
Thank you, Dr. Crystal. Maybe the court has some further questions for you at an appropriate time. Yes, would you remain seated for any questions from our friends in the court?
Thank you, Your Honour. Good morning, Dr. Crystal. I was just going to ask you some questions about that second to last topic my friend addressed with you in terms of overseer. And I understand you were involved in the expert conference that occurred in August last year, when the experts, farm systems experts, were looking at ways in which the different tools that could be used in PC1, is that right?
Yes.
And you might be able to help me with this, but my reading of that joint witness statement, which, if you want to put it up, is attached to Mr. Tribilco's evidence in chief. So behind you there are some folders, and it should be in folder volume 301, behind tab 16. And then the joint witness statement is in Appendix 1, which starts on so page 301-0624 is my reference there. And so it's got your name there as one of the witnesses who signed up to that. If you scroll through, and there might be other places where it's stated, but if you scroll through to turn through to page 301-0655, So this is the August 2022 joint witness statement attached to Mr. Tribilco's evidence. Sorry, sir, I might not have been clear. It's the one that was attached to Mr. Tribilco's evidence in chief from earlier on, so volume 301. And it's tab 15 that follows
the
301.0655. And in fact, if we go back a couple of pages to 0653, we'll see what we've got in front of us is a draft table comparing options identified in overseer discussion paper, and the eight functions overseer performs in PC1. And in terms of the options, it's unpopulated for functions 3 to 8, but functions 1 and 2 draft and gate and establish a baseline respectively. And then when we come through to the last page of that table, we've got option E, status quo, i.e. use of overseer as proposed in decisions version of PC1. And then in the column drafting gate, it says they are not stable as drafting gate, used in concert with other metrics, sensitivity and uncertainty analysis soon to be completed, and may inform this process further. Current view is that it's not fit for regulatory purposes. Now that was the statement as of August last year, and I'm anticipating you're familiar with the work that's been done since, and you would have seen that the week before last, in our last hearing week, a report was tabled that might provide an update on this. And I just wanted to get your current view on this, given the court is now in a position where it's considering is that as other parties, what use overseer might have. And the provisions that Federated Farmers and Beef and Lamb put forward show what reinserting overseer as a drafting gate would look like in one way of doing that. And I just wanted to understand your current opinion with reference to what was stated in this joint witness statement about whether the concerns that you appeared to share at that point have been overcome or whether there are any remaining concerns you have.
Yes, my concerns have been overcome somewhat with the recent work that has been undertaken. The climate data work has shown that the long-term average is fine. It's not just showing any difference when they use daily values. But most importantly, within the sensitivity analysis and the uncertainty analysis, what that was showing is that, particularly for white cattle, there is a significant number of the data points come from this region. So it's the majority are dairy data points, the majority are from the Waikato compared to the whole of New Zealand, free draining soils, etc. And so I actually, it's my professional opinion that when using overseer, when we're talking about uncertainty in those values, that level of uncertainty from the model itself, because we have uncertainty with data input, etc., but from the model itself, relates back to whether or not there was data, field data to generate the equations and the algorithms, or whether it was extrapolated out to the unknowns. And for this region, and for dairy and Waikato, particularly on free draining soils, I'll speak in a minute about some others, I believe that the level of inaccuracy the level of accuracy is greatest, the level of accuracy is the smallest for this subset. So if you were going to use it here, I would be saying to the criteria in my case. The report that Sam's references did talk about some of the limestone landforms in Waikato that overseer wasn't modelling well, and that in those situations I would think that you may wish to use the N-risk scorecard. And the Waikato Regional Council website tells me that those cast landforms on private land, so there's a number on dockland and then the rest are on private land, is 12,000 hectares. Doesn't tell me whether that's dry stock or dairy, but looking at some of the photos under the dairy council, I suspect that the area of dairy under those landforms and that sort of type would be small.
Thank you. So in terms of the statements, the two of the statements, or particularly the first one on that table that I took you to before, would you be confident saying it is now stable as a drafting gate?
Yes.
And is that conclusion one that you'd be confident stepping forward, whether it's an application made next year or in 7 years' time, based on what you know of overseer, the number generated is likely to give us a result that's consistent enough across those years and across different types of dairy farming. That would mean we can be confident it's going to go into the right bucket in terms of the consent process here.
Yes, I think so. I don't know what the future. So you're asking about changes to overseer and how that might change the number. But I'm not clear on the future program for research, what that overseer has, but I highly suspect that it's not going to be dairy in Waikato because they have so many data points, it's likely to be crops and those sorts of things. And that, so what happens when you get a new number, it's because there's new data or new information that's going to a component of the model. And so unless there's a significant change in our knowledge for dairy and Waikato, then it's unlikely
you done any work at this point to compare the outputs of the NRS with Overseer in its current form to be able to provide any comment on its equivalency?
Your question about paragraph 46 of your evidence. It's paragraph 46, page 10, EBD reference 307.0084. So I interpret that diagram to be telling me that nitrogen fertilizers are one source of nitrogen loss. And you've also attached to your evidence of the literature review, which was referred to earlier. And I'd like to ask you a question about that. My specific question relates to the paragraph on page 145, which is EBD 307.0229. So in that section of your literature review, you're considering critical source area management.
Yes.
And on page 145, the second paragraph down, you refer to a study, Telford Suffertago study,
yes.
And on the line immediately below where it refers to the Telford Suffertago study, it talks nitrogen loss from 10 kgs nitrogen per hectare to 2 kgs nitrogen per hectare?
To less than 2.
To less than 2. So that's a decrease in nitrogen loss of 8 kgs. And that decrease, that's the result of the management of critical source areas?
That decrease is the result of management of the paddock, which includes management of the critical source areas. So that was a water crop paddock, and they were comparing two catchments, one catchment where they grazed at that time bottom up. So you've got bare soil where the dairy cows have grazed, and then any runoff is going back down. And the other one with the strategic grazing, they graze from the tops down towards the critical source area, leave that fenced and ungrazed, and then they graze just at the end of winter, just let the cows in quickly and out. What I will say with that nitrogen leaching, because you spoke, the question before was about fertilizer, is that the significant source of nitrogen in that situation was urine, not fertilizer.
And was that, I guess, a comparison, a two-paddock comparison, that, I think I saw something that you said the results were striking before you even done the sediment?
Yes.
So explain, how were the results striking?
So, in terms of when we had those water samples, you can actually, you can see one is, there's sediment in that sample from the unprotected catchment versus the protected, and it was a lot clearer for the drink harvest.
With the drink harvest? Good to know. And in terms of the, I guess, the test case paddock that had the I guess, the best practice management, what methods were used? Was it metric things?
Yes, so those paddocks, so it was a dairy situation, so we're dry dairy cows. The electric fence was put up around the critical source area before the cows went into the paddock. This was back in 2011 or 2012, so just keeping in mind that our winter practices have significantly changed since then, so what was standard is just not done anymore. And so the electric fence was put up before the cows came in, and then the brakes moved with that electric fence around the critical source area and remained there.
The brakes moved?
Sorry, so the cows are brake fed, so the cows are fed behind a wire, and there's a portable water trough with each brake, so they serve them out of the paddock each day, and each day you move so that they you only allow the cows their daily ration. It's kind of like sugar with children. If you let them have the whole paddock,
they'll eat the whole lot. And that technology works with the fence and the movable trucks?
Yes, it does. It's particularly for those intensive situations where you've got a smaller paddock. In large situations where you've got extensive areas, it's more difficult. But in those situations where your animals are in an intensive situation, you've got one or two paddocks, then yes, it does work.
And are you familiar with Schedule C from the Climate Change Fund?
Yes, I am.
That doesn't require stock exclusion of sheep, does it?
No, it doesn't.
So the comment about the electric fences not being particularly useful to keep sheep out, that's a very hearing, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, sheep tend to go there. Those electric fences, knock those fences down or get caught up in those electric fences. So it's actually a bit of an animal welfare issue when you've got sheep in the paddock.
And sheep tend not to go to water?
And wool, they don't like water. Because
the wool gets heavy. Have you seen, I guess balanced agri-nutrients, they have some involvement in farm plans.
Yes.
And have you seen the, just thinking about your paddock comparison, have you seen the model that the balanced agri-nutrients, I guess their sales team, have at science fairs or trade shows?
No.
It's a side-by-side comparison model that shows a farm with buffers and fencing and a farm without. Have you seen that model? So in terms of the results of that study that you talked about, the two paddocks, would you say that the protecting of that critical source area had an impact on retaining soil within the paddock?
Absolutely. And as I said earlier, that was done some time ago, and that has led to quite a change in practice in terms of that. Protecting a critical source area. There's another, there's been work done with sheep, and what the scientists are now suggesting is not even cropping that critical source area, so leaving that completely uncropped, and still protecting it as well, and but doing the same to strategic, and they're getting further reductions.
Further reductions?
From if you crop that.
Oh, right, that makes sense.
Yes, yeah.
And I guess if you're not in terms of reduction, so you're losing your soil from the land. So logically, if you're losing your soil, you're losing less applied nitrogen fertilizer.
Not the fertilizer itself, it depends when that prick or source area or when that loss of contaminant is occurring, because ideally farmers are not applying fertilizer at times when there's going to be a runoff event, but what they will be using is the nutrient that's in the soil, so it's not the fertilizer but it's that topsoil, which is why for particularly those intensive grazing events or occurrences, the protection of the critical source areas is essential.
Makes good business sense.
Absolutely.
In that, if you're losing less nutrients, you don't have to buy as much nitrogen fertilizer.
The calculations have been done, and it's not as much of a saving as you would think. But yes, probably phosphorus more than nitrogen in those situations, but at least by retaining the nutrient in the topsoil.
There's a cost saving.
A small cost saving, yes.
And do you know the cost of nitrogen fertilizer?
Not currently, no.
Would it be fair to say that nitrogen fertilizer as an input cost is a high one or a large cost?
It completely depends on the farm system. So, for example, dry stock farms, a lot of them apply very little nitrogen fertiliser, none or small amounts to pasture, not to the whole farm, compared to, say, a dairy situation or an intensive dry stock situation where you're using nitrogen to boost that feedback pasture supply and you might have quite high rates of nitrogen. But in comparison, there are farms that are applying very, very little, and so it wouldn't be a significant cost for those farms.
But I guess, do you agree with the proposition that a reduction in nitrogen fertilizer costs would offset the cost of the electric fence?
So the problem when you reduce your I guess it's an understanding problem. If by reducing your fertilizer inputs you reduce feed that's run, you then therefore reduce production. So then so if it's milk production or land growth rates, you have less product to sell. So you may be applying less fertilizer, but you've got less product, so you've got less income. And so it's very difficult to know how much would you reduce it by, and I suggest that it would be very little, because that loss of nutrient is at a time of the year when you're not actually applying fertiliser. So it's not a direct fertiliser loss.
So just move to the Waikato complex. Are you from the Waikato?
No, I'm from Dunedin.
Same. Well, originally, currently Waikato. The question for you is, in preparing for this hearing, have you been to Lake Naroto?
No.
About Lake Waikiri?
No.
Are Lake Whangarei?
No.
How about the Whangarei wetlands? Do you know where those Lake Naroto, for example, has a sign up saying don't touch the water for health reasons? Have you read Te Tiri Whamana?
Have I read it? No.
Have you heard of it?
Yes, where the health of the water is the first priority.
Have you seen the objectives of PC1? Using the term restore and protect?
Yes.
And have you heard of the precautionary approach? That wasn't a trick question.
Yeah.
So, just move now to the critical source. include the water quality permit assessment?
Yes, but it was if I can find it.
Yeah, I can do that. So it's volume 401. In the page I just talked about is the question at question 42. And that,
sorry, is it tab?
Oh, tab 401027.
Tab 1.
Yeah. So your question 42, which is 0027. So that question there, the water quality expert, sorry, but have you seen for that you're not a water quality expert? So you went at this conference. So at this conference, and the water quality experts were asked to consider are inclement waterways a significant source of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, and E. coli? And if so, what measures could be put in place to mitigate these? And in response, they, the matters of agreement. The first point, the experts agreed that we consider that inferior waterways are a significant source of contaminants to downstream water bodies because they concentrate runoff during rainfall. And mitigation actions include temporary permanent fencing and management of these areas as critical source areas. That's point two. So my understanding of your evidence is that you agree that critical source areas are a significant source of contaminants.
Yes, I do.
You agree. And essentially, on reviewing the critical source area, that is likely to include an inferior stream, and that's a significant source of contaminants. And that's because they accumulate runoff from adjacent land.
So they have a critical source area with two components, and one is a source of contaminant, and the other is a mechanism or pathway to transport that contaminant to a water body.
Yes, the transport pathway.
Yes, yeah. And you're going to feel more water body with the transport pathway.
So in terms of the did you hear Mr. Berry give evidence yesterday?
Yes, I did.
And did you hear him at one stage respond, this is not word for word, but along the lines of we talked about different who was going to be the certifier of farm claims, whether it's currently unclear who's going to be in those roles, different qualifications coming from different perspectives. Do you remember that?
Yes,
part of the discussion. And I guess I just want to understand the different approaches that could be taken to disproportionately large. So the term disproportionately large, one approach is to talk about it on a farm scale. So on a single farm, are we saying disproportionately large compared to the rest of the farm? Is that one approach that could be taken?
I guess when I think of that too, what I'm thinking about is, say, a paddock where you've got your spread of dun, or say dun, neuro patches, etc. across and you're going to get some slight runoff from a pattern, but you've got those critical source areas which is going to transport a larger proportion, disproportionate to the area that it's coming from, than the rest of the pattern. And so to me, that's that disproportionate, because although you may have the same amount of contaminant, because of that pathway is taking your fill. That's where I'm looking. And in terms of comparing, I would, if it's in a farm plan, you would not be comparing with other farms. You're looking at those risks on your own farm. So you're not saying, because I am this critical source area is smaller than my neighbour across the fence, I'm going to ignore it. So this critical source area is significant within my farm's context. It's the most significant loss or the highest risk that I identified. And so you're not ignoring something because you believe that others are doing worse.
Did you have evidence when Mr. Robertson locked your farms?
Some of it.
I think at one point he said he litigates the farm plans. Is that common? Is that sometimes happens?
I don't know.
I'll come a different way. So, and I guess where I'm headed to is, in the absence of minimum standards, and we end up in a market situation with certifiers, it's possible, isn't it, that some farms will, in terms of dealing through that improvement process of their farm plan, raise arguments around the critical source areas on their land is not disproportionately large compared to the catchment.
I have not seen that, or I just actually hear that Thomas Robinson again. I'm unsure how the process is going to work in terms of when you have a freshwater farm plan and it's certified, whether you can then contest it. If that's what you're saying, you're contesting what your farm planner is. I would be hoping that a farm plan is done in conjunction with the farmer, right? And we've heard that a lot from some of the witnesses, and the farmer needs to be on board. And one thing is that farm environment plans were originally not designed to support a regulatory process. These are tools that are for the farming business and are hugely advantageous to the farmer and to the business in terms of understanding those areas of risk. And it's not just a farm environment plan, it's part of your business plan and your work safe and your animal health. All those sorts of things that a farmer has to consider as a whole. And so it's actually understanding that this is a useful tool for a farmer, and so we need to, I think, keep that in mind, because if we turn this into a regulatory burden, then the farmer who's paying for this isn't appreciative of the document, it isn't going to value what that document holds.
And I guess, would you say that the farm plan is part of the carrot picture, and that it's helping people lift practices to the point where the business is more profitable?
Yes.
So it's part of the carrot approach.
It's more profitable, and I can't think of a farmer that I've spoken to who doesn't want to improve their farming business in terms of reducing the environmental impact. Everybody talks about, we're guardians of this land, and in my opinion, it's about the farm plan is their education, and because it's related to a farmer's own parcel of land, it has so much
Have you seen the latest circulated version of Schedule C? Yes, that's right. Turn that to the page that I'm referring to here, which is the very last clause about the carve-out for the infamous strings. Had you seen that carve-out? The schedule say the Federated Farmers on the last page where it's got the infamous strings.
I asked for a copy of this document, and I understand that Federated Farmers has. Do you have copies? That what was the document handed out by Fonterra last week?
Yes, she's got
it. Right, I was just trying to put up the call.
Oh, that one, okay.
So, I guess the point that I'm here to is that the Schedule C, the proposal is to remove any reference to, or to remove carve out of people's strings.
To be honest, I don't recall that last paragraph, but it was quite a lot going on last week, but I've got it here.
So, I guess in light of our discussion about how the critical service areas often include internal strains, and in light of what the JWS recovery has said, and I guess the striking results from managing these areas, there is the carried approach of the farm environment plans. But in every situation, there's a tail, isn't there? And at minimum, standards can help bring up the tail.
Yes. So my understanding of Schedule C is that these are farms that fit under a low intensity. And we already have the national regulations for intensive integrating and the protection of critical source areas, which would incorporate female streams in the national regulations. And so my understanding is that this Schedule C, because when you get into D1 and D2, you do have to look at critical source areas, this is for those lower intensity farm systems. And so I am less concerned with the risk from intensive farming practices on the international.
So just returning, that's my last question, just returning to the Waikato context. The extent of degradation, the direction of Tutori Wana for restore and protect, precautionary approach, and the objectives of PC1. In the absence of minimum standards to bring up that tail, how confident are you that the PC targets will be met under the ADU and the shorter term targets?
I'm a water quality scientist, and so my knowledge is of what we can do on farm to reduce so from the water or whatever. And from my literature review, I really do think that we can achieve the 20-year targets with some of those mitigations that are in there in terms of. Bringing out the tail up.
Thank you.
we'll take a brief adjournment now.